I'm going to call the House Hess meeting together. And this is February 27th. It is 5 minutes after 3:00. And those presents are Representative Faircloth, Representative Gardner, Representative Roses, and myself, Representative Wilson. And here comes Representative Seaton. So I'll kind of go over our schedule. First of all, our House Secretary, Kelly, is here again, Kelly Burnett. She records all of our meetings, and so please turn your cell phones off, because when we have too much extra noise in here, she doesn't hear what's being said. So our moderator is Steve Breachy. He handles all the technical operations. And the order of business today is we're going to do HCR 3 first, and that's going to be the first one that we're going to hear. That's the Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which is April, and then HJR 10, Denali Kid Care Funding. And then we're going to have a presentation by the System for Early Education Development, or SEED. And so let's get started. I think the first two will be relatively quick.
Don't ever say that.
Assume that. But you never know. You never know what's going to take longer than you think. So let's get started. And Representative Myers, do you want to come forward?
All right. Got a laptop here. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Hess Committee. It's indeed a privilege to be here before you again to talk about House Concurrent Resolution Number 3, proclaiming April 2007 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And I might add, too, that we've been working with Representative Faircloth and her office on this resolution as well. And it's a difficult issue to talk about, and one that people don't typically like to talk about. It's embarrassing. It's hard. But it's one of those issues that we need to talk about. And the more we can talk about it, the better the whole state is. It acknowledges that sexual assault is a problem in this state, and we need to do everything we can to prevent it and to educate people on it, on the issue. And by observing this month as Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we're encouraging schools, community organizations, state agencies, and other individuals to seek out or sponsor activities, again, to help educate the general public about sexual assault in the state. And unfortunately, the statistics are devastating and very sobering to all of us here in Alaska. It's one of the most violent and unreported crimes in the state. Alaska's forcible rape is 2.5 times higher than the national average. Our rape rate is higher than even California and Washington put together. We have 6 times the national average of reported child sexual assault. And these are just numbers that have been reported. As we all know, again, it's embarrassing and difficult to report these numbers, so we're sure we don't have all the numbers, but even the numbers we do have, that it's not good. In 2006, the Alaska Network of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault conducted a survey and asked public opinion on domestic violence and sexual assault, and they found that of 75% that they had contacted, the people they had contacted, 75% had either experienced or knew someone who had experienced domestic violence or sexual assault. And over the past few years, as many of you know, we've passed some pretty tough laws dealing with sexual assault. We had one just last session, Senator Bundy and Senator Gretchen Guess. But laws themselves aren't going to do any good unless we can make people aware of the laws and aware of this activity going on. So that's what this resolution does. Again, just trying to create more of awareness, and as a society, try to make a statement that it's not going to be tolerated, and that there are things that we can do. There are laws in place that are tough, as long as we know about the crimes, and support those organizations and assist the sexual assault survivors and their loved ones, comfort them who have been victims, but yet at the same time try to prevent any other people from being victims. So, Madam Chair, this appreciate the consideration of this committee of this resolution. Again, I thank Representative Fairclough and her office for their assistance. And she, as you know, was the past director of STAR, Stand Together Against Rape, and could probably talk about this. Well, no, I know she could talk more about this subject than I could, and I can't. But anyway, Madam Chair, this is the same resolution I've brought forward previous years, and again, appreciate the committee's time.
Have you ever thought of making it permanently so you didn't have to do this every year?
Well, then I wouldn't be able to come to see this committee. Actually, that's a good idea. No, we have not thought about doing that, but I don't see why we couldn't make April the Sexual Assault Awareness Month. I will check on that.
Okay. Let the record show that Representative Newman has joined us. And Representative Fairclough, you have a question or comment?
Actually, a comment, but Representative Dahl is in the audience also. Oh. I don't know if you want to recognize her.
Yes, please. Representative, we do have an empty seat if you want to come forward. Okay, thank you for coming.
Just on the record, I do appreciate all that this body and specifically Representative Meyer has done to support victims across the state of Alaska, but specifically victims who are children. He has a special interest and passion for. He is a previous board member on Standing Together Against Rape, and I believe now serves on the Boys and Girls Club. And so I am sad to say that generational violence is existent. It does exist in the state of Alaska, and bring a resolution forward every year is a small gesture in trying to bring to the attention, both at a legislative level and at a state level, the issue that is reoccurring, unfortunately, in victims' homes, sometimes every day of the year. And so I just wanted to, again, say publicly thank you to Representative Meyer and a group, as well as all of the legislature. Historically, the last 6 years, sexual assault and domestic violence have seen increased attention by this body, by the other body in this building, and victims appreciate it. Community organizations that have to go out in the middle of the night and respond to those in crisis really appreciate the additional attention and thought for those who can't defend themselves. So thank you, Representative Meyer, and thank you for all of you who have supported increased accountability for perpetrators in this state.
Do we increase, like, our PSA announcements on the radio and during this April? I don't know if there's a increase all at once because of the picking April as that month. Is there more of awareness for the public during that month?
Madam Chair, what Representative Meyer has requested all citizens of Alaska to do and what local networking agencies do is reach out to the community at this particular time, and we ask for additional PSAs, and we pay, I can only speak from STAR, but for the last 3 years, I believe we paid almost $8,000 for PSA announcements to go about out protecting your child and talking about increased awareness of the issues around violence.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very much aware, I think as probably everybody in this room is, that sexual assault and violence is a huge problem in Alaska. And I'd like to make one comment and then ask a question also. I don't know the exact ratio, but I know that these appalling statistics correspond very highly with our alcoholism rate, our rate of alcohol abuse. And a lot of times this violence and assault, just as in crime in general, correlates with alcohol abuse, or alcohol abuse rather. But my question is, do we know if our astonishing rate of violence, I didn't know that it was higher than, what is it, Washington and Oregon together? Is that
Washington and California.
I mean, is that in any way part of an increasing awareness, disclosure, services offered? I mean, is there any reason to think that maybe we're a little more proactive and people come forward more than in other places? Have we made any progress in that area? And I don't know if that's a question for the sponsor or for Representative Fairclough.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'll take half of that, Representative Fairclough. The half I'll take is the part dealing with alcohol, and that you're certainly correct, that alcohol and drugs play a big part in sexual assault. And I think it was, I want to say 3 years ago, actually I had a bill making sexual assault by use of an aggravator a stiffer penalty. In other words, a judge could find somebody guilty of sexual assault, and then if they also found that alcohol was being used, then that could be considered as an aggravator and could be added to the crime. As far as, you know, are the numbers higher now because more people are aware and they're reporting it? I'd like to think that's part of it, but I think Representative Faircloth probably has a better feel for that as Director Starr.
Madam Chair.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to poach a little bit on the alcohol issue first. About 80% of either the perpetrator or the victim have alcohol on board in a situation of rape. And I'm sure the number is equal in domestic violence, if not higher. And that's purely off of statistics, off of a UAA study, UAA Justice study in the Anchorage area. For our police department, we had noted that 80% of those clientele that reported either the victim or the perpetrator alcohol was involved. Speaking to our incidency rate, I think there's some truth to at least the child numbers that we have educated out in the Anchorage School District at a much higher level than we had in the past. We used to touch about 2,000 kids, and that would mean going into, you know, 10 classrooms in a year. Now we touch about 7,000 kids, and we're probably in through the September, April period. I mean, we're not usually in there in May, and we're not usually in there, but for about a six to eight month period, we touch about 7,000 kids now. And that rate of reporting has almost doubled then. So in 2001, when I first came on as the executive director, I think I spoke to this somewhere yesterday, we had about 255 cases reporting perpetrators, someone had perpetrated on them. And after we did the 7,000 students for a period of just 1 year, that rate doubled to almost 650. And that's remained constant as long as we're constantly out there talking in classrooms to 7,000 kids. So for 2 years following that we have actual reports on, we held at the 600 number with the additional education. So our kids may be reporting more frequently, but I'd have to say, you know, when you look at trend lines, the adult population has stayed the same every year. I mean, there's about 250 women in Anchorage that report rape to the police every year, and that stays fairly consistent. And the whole state reports about 500, and that's in large aggregate numbers, but Anchorage has about 50% of those cases in the urban area, but we have almost 50% of the population, so it's a big issue.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm trying to draw back a little bit when I had introduced, of course, my version of Jessica's Law that was eventually folded into Senator Bundy's bill. On the House side, I carried that on the House side. And I think that there's a lot more awareness, and there's society is a lot less tolerant than it was to sexual crimes. You know, what used to be assumed, well, that's just, you know, that's okay. I think we're seeing a lot less of that. A lot of it swept under the rug, you know, what it used to be. There's just less tolerance of it, and people are more aware of it. But several things that have just kind of popped into my mind is how this comes up each year in front of the legislature. I think it's good to have this discussion yearly in front of the legislature. I think it helps the awareness. I really do. I mean, we could have this, just say, well, we could take April out of this bill and just make it in perpetuity, but I think that it's good to have this discussion every year for that fact. But I also think that and if I believe right, I'm trying to go back on my memory on the numbers, it's only about 27% of all the crimes committed are actually reported in the state. And so, you know, we're only talking about a quarter of the people who are affected by this, and it's literally a lifetime sentence. And it's so difficult. But I can take myself as an example. Is I was very ignorant on the facts because it had never affected my life. And I wasn't aware. And when I started working, I had a grandmother, this is just a short story if I may. I had a grandmother call me up and tell me what happened to her granddaughter and how he was released back out of prison and asked me, you know, Representative Newman, would you sponsor Jessica's Law in the state of Alaska? And I said, absolutely. And right then I committed to doing this. So I think that there's people like myself and certainly Representative Faircloth and the members of this body. The more aware that we are of this, the more we're willing to get involved. And granted, as it was discussed earlier, the more I got involved in this, the more it hurt. Because there was things happening that I never thought imaginable. And it just, you know, I would sit with Portia Parker and Susan Parks in my office, and they would tell me some of this, and I could never think of such crimes against humanity or people like this. And two weeks ago, when Representative Faircloth and Senator Dyson sponsored a youth sexual awareness at the youth luncheon, and some of the statistics that were thrown out there, I think it's really starting to hit home. I think we're really starting to punch people right in the guts on this, you know, and the awareness that's happening, and there's getting less tolerant in society, finally. It's taken a while, but again, we're still only at 27% in the state, and when we look at the statistics, and even with those numbers, we have more reportable crimes. Recidivism rates for perpetrators is extremely low, depending on age level, anywhere from 9 to 17%. You know, where do we go on some of this stuff? But I think it's good to have these discussions. Just more or less comments, Madam Chair, with a little bit of, I know the recognition that I've had just in the last couple of years, again, of working on mandatory sentencing for sexual molesters, the many hours that I've spent working on that bill and the research that I've did, testifying on it, beating back amendments, you know, that actually tried to lighten sentences. It was very difficult and very hard for me to do, and it's still very difficult for me to speak to this day, to some of these crimes against our youth in society. But I think that this is good to have these discussions. As Representative Meyer said, it's very difficult to talk about, extremely difficult to talk about. And it's our job to talk about it. But imagine what it's like just for somebody on the street, just the average public person to talk about this with their neighbors and their friends to open up their lives. I think it's even more difficult. So whatever we can do to help this happen in rural Alaska, it's extremely bad. Just a little bit of food for thought. Thank you, Chair.
And I think we need to, I think it's good, like Representative Gardner brought out, that the percentage of alcohol that's involved with it. And I look forward to the day when alcohol isn't accepted in society. You know, there's too many people that that we haven't gotten there with the alcohol yet, and we just need to keep talking about it. So, Representative Roses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to echo some of the same thoughts that have already been out there. I won't repeat them. I will say that I think some of the education that's gone on in the schools that Representative Faircloth has already commented on is absolutely accurate. The raising the level of awareness in the schools is what's going to give you the long-range effects. And I will also tell you that when legislation was passed quite a number of years ago requiring that teachers have to report any incidences that they suspect, you don't get to investigate it as a teacher anymore. You have to report it if you suspect it and let the authorities sort it out. So I think some of the reporting issues that have come up through the years, as well as the educational awareness issues, is what has probably brought more of this to light. I'm hoping that in my heart, that's why we're seeing more numbers and that it's not actually more crimes. And so anything we can do to help, I think we should. And that's why I think you'll see some legislation coming out of my office, and as a matter of fact, tomorrow in judiciary on this very subject. So.
Okay. And let the record show that Representative Sisna has joined us. And Representative
Dahl.
Sorry. Go ahead.
You want to come up to the mic?
Yeah, please come forward and have a seat.
Just a moment. I'm just very glad to hear this discussion. And Andrea Dahl, for the record, Representative Andrea Dahl from Juneau. But just for the record, I'm glad to hear the discussion about bringing it into the community for discussion. And Representative Newman, I appreciate that comment. Some of you may be aware that I did work for AWARE, Women Shelter, just a year ago. And when I was in that capacity, I was at a sort of a fair, you might say a community fair, where we had booths. And AWARE had cookies and various kinds of things there at this booth. And we also had fact sheets. And I was fairly new there, so I was very interested to see how the community would take our booth and react to it. Well, people would come over, and there was sort of this sense of, oh, this is really fun, let's go do things, and let's go at the tables, and what's going on? And they would come to the table, and then they'd just stop, and then they'd quickly turn and go away. And it was just one of these things like, oh, we don't want to talk about this. Oh, that's just not what I want to think about today. This isn't what I want to talk about. So it takes me back to the point that Representative Newman was talking about when he said, let's make this a subject for community discussion, where it is part of a community. It's not in the closet anymore. It's not hidden. It is something that's out, but now we need to feel comfortable talking about it. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Christine Ashenburner, would you like to come forward and state your affiliation and give us your testimony?
Yes, thank you. I'm Chris Ashenbrenner, or Christine Ashenbrenner. I am the interim program administrator for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, rather long title. And I think I'm speaking to the choir here. I want to thank you for your leadership. I want to thank Representative Myers for and Representatives Fairclough and Stoltz for bringing this forward. I think also that it's very important to bring it up every single year. One of the sad stories when I worked at AWARE also here in Juneau is a story about a woman who had been raped in a car by some guys, a number of guys, taken and shoved out of that car in the winter. And she walked through a neighborhood looking for a light on because she didn't want to bother anybody who didn't have their light on. And so when I was thinking about this resolution, I was thinking about this in terms of keeping the light on. It keeps the light on across the state, to the legislature, to everybody. It's very important that we keep talking about this, take it out of the closet, say it's wrong, censure it, hold perpetrators accountable, and support victim services. So I thank you in advance for passing this resolution, and welcome to take any questions. Although I think Representative Fairclough could answer more accurately.
Representative Gardner?
Gives new meaning to the phrase, we'll keep the light on for you.
Yes. Yes, thank you for keeping the light on.
Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Pardon? Eliana, make the motion.
Yeah. Would you like to
make
a motion?
I would. I just have to read it over here. It'll be the second time I move something. I'd like to move House Concurrent Resolution Number 3 from committee. It's 25-LS0471-M. Correct. Good. With any individual recommendations, and I don't think there's a fiscal note on this one.
Hearing no objection, that has been moved. All right. Thank you. And next we will go to HJR 10, Denali Kid Care Funding. And my intern is going to present this. This is a new experience for him, so we're going to just let him do the presenting. He's worked hard on this.
Screwing up somebody's setup up here.
You can go ahead and close that laptop.
Okay, thanks.
I was going to offer get his feet wet, but you know, out of the closet, feet wet.
It's okay, I can re-spend it for us with the best of them. For the record, my name is Robert Myers, Jr. I'm an intern in Representative Wilson's office. I'm coming to you this afternoon to speak on House Joint Resolution Number 10, dealing with Denali Kid Care funding. Denali Kid Care is actually one small part of a much larger program called the State Children's Health Insurance Program, or SCHIP. Due in large part to the SCHIP program, the percentage of low-income children in the United States without health care has fallen by one quarter since SCHIP was created in 1997. This is despite the erosion of private health coverage over this period. More than 4 million low-income children across the United States, most of whom would be otherwise uninsured, are enrolled in SCHIP. This remarkable success, however, is now threatened. Unlike Medicaid, which is an entitlement program whose federal funding increases automatically to compensate for increases in healthcare costs and caseloads, SCHIP is a block grant with a fixed annual funding level. That block grant is due to run out in September 2007 with the end of the current federal fiscal year. And like KidCare, the form of SCHIP in Alaska will be put in a very precarious situation when that happens. Now, the SCHIP program was instituted in 1997 under the Balanced Budget Act and was given 10 years of funding by Congress, and that included almost $40 billion total for those 10 years. The last one was $5 billion for fiscal year 2007. However, unfortunately, there are currently no more allocations out there at the moment. The number of children in the program in Alaska has been declining since 2003 because of the frozen income guidelines with the change from Senate Bill 105 in that year. And approximately half of those children that have dropped out of the program are now covered by Medicaid. In 2003, Alaska spent almost $1,200 more per enrollee for Medicaid than the national average, which ranks us as second highest in the nation of expenditures per child for Medicaid. In Denali KidCare, currently we have roughly 7,600 children enrolled. In the state fiscal year 2006, we spent $25.9 million. Of that, $7.7 million was state money. Federal money accounted for $18.2 million. So you can see the problem that we're going to have if we lose the federal funding for this program. The state spends an average of $2,114 per child, or $1,966 per pregnant woman enrolled in Denali KidCare. Out of all of the Medicaid programs that the state of Alaska administers, this is the cheapest expenditure per enrollee of any of those Medicaid programs. Now, in the past, Alaska has also relied heavily on unallocated funds from the general SCHIP fund. For example, if another state such as, say, Virginia did not use all of its allotted federal funding, we could simply ask the folks that administer the SCHIP program in DC to send some of that unallocated funding to Alaska in case we needed a little bit extra. Now, Alaska happened to jump on the bandwagon of SCHIP quite a bit faster than a lot of other states. However, the rest of the country is caught up by now, which means that there are no longer any more unallocated SCHIP funds. And in fact, because of this, Alaska has had a shortfall and is one of 14 states that had a shortfall over this past fiscal year. Congress did pass some additional funding for SCHIP for this current fiscal year. However, we're still scheduled to run out sometime in May of 2007. The Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, or FMAP, for 2007 is 57.58% for regular Medicaid programs and 70.31% enhanced. Now, what this means is out of every $100 that we spend on a Medicaid program, for most of those Medicaid programs, the federal government will give us $57.58. Denali KidCare, however, is on the enhanced program, which means out of every $100 we spend, we're going to be getting $70.31 from the feds. However, this FMAP is projected to drop. For 2008, we are anticipating roughly a 67-33% federal-state split for enhanced Medicaid, of which Denali KidCare is part. Now, on the upside, the budget that President Bush has submitted to Congress does include a provision to extend SCHIP for 5 years and increased the funding by $5 billion over that time. And finally, we just ask the committee to pass this resolution to urge Congress, and then I'll ask our governor as well to work with our congressional delegation to ensure that the funding for Denali Kid Care continues. And that concludes what I have, if you have any questions.
Thank you, Rob. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I always have a question about these things, partly because it is so complex. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding correctly. The FMAP funding, we currently get 71% back from the feds.
Correct.
For programs like the SCHIP, of which Denali Kid Care is one of them. But we're running out of funding. Are we spending then more than we've been allocated, or we're not being reimbursed? I mean, if we move forward with a program in anticipation of getting 71% reimbursement, or down the road, say 67% reimbursement, and the is there a possibility the feds just plain won't come through with it?
The way it works is that SCHIP is a block grant, so they have allocated a certain amount of money for us, and they will match us up to that amount of cash for, you know, given current percentage for whatever we want to spend as well. If we want to go beyond that, it's going to drop down to, it's either going to disappear, or we can put these kids into Medicaid and get the lower percentage under Medicaid rather than the higher percentage under the enhanced FMAP.
Follow up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. My concern is, as the feds are cutting their budgets and cutting reimbursements and stuff, is there any possibility that we could be a recipient of a block grant and go ahead and spend that money but not actually get it?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I'm afraid you're going to have to ask Congress that one.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you. I can only speak from limited experience with the federal government, but in my past employment, I was promised a grant, a federal block grant, and they didn't fund it, and we didn't get it after it was approved and awarded.
And spent?
We were smart enough not to spend it first.
And I think there's at the federal level, there's the granting of something, but then it's kind of like, if the money's there, you'll get it. That's kind of the thought, and so you don't spend it until you have it. And that's kind of the way it is. And so it sounds like to me that in the middle of May, which we will have all of the rest of May and all of June yet, that we will be out of funds for that, and the state will be paying more.
Representative Wilson, if I may also, we will be running out of money in May, and then we deal with June as well. However, that is it for the state fiscal year. We also have to deal with the rest of the federal fiscal year, which runs through September. So we're running out of money for May, June, July, August, and September as well. And that's assuming that Congress says, okay, we're going to start spending more money for fiscal year 2008. So even if they renew it, we still have to deal with that roughly 4.5 month gap.
And you know, I know that there's somebody in the audience that will probably be able to tell us what they plan to do if that happens. But Representative Fairclough, you had a question.
Well, that was going to be my question, and I can hold it for the commissioner if we want. But my question was going to be, then once we hit May and we're out of funds, can we switch to the 52% or 53% Medicaid reimbursement, or are we down to?
And I've got a feeling that there's a different qualification for that. It seems like in my head it's that. So anybody else have any questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. And I guess quick comment on some of the discussion earlier. There's a big difference between approved and appropriated.
Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of. Yep.
Line on page 2, we look at line 5 and line 19. We look at, and it talks about children of modest means and children who qualify for. What are the sideboards or parameters on who qualifies and who does not qualify?
The qualifications are spelled out in Alaska statute. If you give me a second, I can find the number if you're interested. But it was stated at 175% of the federal poverty level as of 2003, once you factor in inflation and such. Currently, we're running at roughly 160% of federal poverty level.
And also, during, I think it was that year, the legislature froze that so that they put in the amount, so that the amount stays the same, but as cost of living and everything else climbs, that didn't, so. Representative Newman?
Thank you, and Robert, do you know what, I mean, we hear 175% of poverty level, is there a number for a family of four?
I don't have the figures on me at the
total household income?
But they do it by family size, family one, family two, up through, and they've got it specifically listed through number eight.
Maybe the commission can tell us.
And then it's additional per child after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think it's close to 40, between 40 and 42,000, I don't know where for sure that's at. Any other questions before I have the commissioner come up? Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 21, we have a copy of the resolution, shall be sent to the Honorable Ted Stevens, et cetera. In a previous resolution, we queried the Lieutenant Governor's office, and unless we specify by electronic means, they send these as hard copy. So I'm wondering whether the sponsor would agree to conceptual amendment after sent by electronic method and hard copy to the insertion of something like that in conceptual language, so we make sure that this gets back to them in a very timely manner.
Both electronically.
Yes.
Certified mail.
Okay. Do you want to make that into a motion?
Do you want it now or during?
Well, yeah. Let's get the rest of the testimony.
I just wanted to put it on the record just one thing.
Rob?
I pulled out the Alaska statute with regards to the funding levels, and this is as of 2003, this was 175% of federal matching, 175% of the federal poverty level for a household of one person, $1,635 a month, two people, $2,208, three people, $2,782, and so on down the list. And as I said, that's down to roughly 160% now with those dollar figures.
Representative Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we request copies of that for the committee?
Sure. Okay, thank you. And thank you, Rob. And Commissioner, would you come forward? And you probably will be able to fill us in where we weren't sure about some of this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I really wanted to thank you for putting forward this resolution and to give you a little bit of an update that the governor, in fact, has been, well, I apologize, Carlene Jackson, for the record, Commissioner for Health and Social Services. The governor has actually been back in Washington, D.C., as you know, and did meet with Secretary Leavitt, the Secretary for Health and Human Services, about this issue. And the National Governors Association, as well, has also taken up the issue of the Children's Health Insurance Program funding. And in addition to that, Senator Lisa Murkowski, we've also been in conversation with, and she's very supportive. So I think your resolution is very timely. I think getting it to folks electronically is a great idea. And I just wanted to thank you, and then would be happy to answer what questions I might be able to that you might have.
Representative Faircloth?
You heard the previous speaker say that we will be out of funding for Denali Kid Care in May, and we have a delta between May and the federal fiscal year that we need to provide services for or funding for. Do we qualify for a pickup of the state for a Medicaid reimbursement?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, there's two issues actually with SCHIP. This resolution gets at reauthorizing the SCHIP program, which absolutely has to happen first or nothing else matters. The other issue has been in the past, we've got redistributed funds, as was explained, from other states that haven't used all their SCHIP funding. There's also a component where states are talking about the formula they might use for redistribution of funds. And so potentially that could help with our shortfall before we'd have to look at other alternatives like Medicaid. But this funding, as so many of you know and have worked on, is some of the prevention funding that, as was mentioned earlier, gets at saving money down the road. So we're going to do whatever we need to do to make sure we can keep this program intact through Denali KidCare.
Representative Newell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of was curious, Carmen, how many, do you know any idea, or maybe the chair knows, how many resolutions like this have been put forward in the past? Is this like the first time that we've had to present a resolution to ask for funding?
I think this may be the first time. I can't remember.
I was just trying to look at, to see how stable this was, and to be able to gauge it.
I don't remember.
If I may.
Please.
I'm afraid I don't know if there have been any resolutions in the past, but when Congress first authorized this in 1997, they did stipulate the dollar amounts for each block grant for the next 10 years. So while we may have been running short on money for a particular fiscal year before this, I'm not entirely sure on that, we have never have yet to have a problem where we didn't know if we were going to get any money the next fiscal year.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Seaton.
I'm sorry, maybe I was not paying attention. did we get the answer to the question of if we run out of money, does it go to Medicaid?
Not really.
There's several other things we can try first.
Okay.
Right.
Well, yeah. Thanks.
Is there anyone else online, or do we have anyone online that would like to testify? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? Okay, then I'm going to close testimony. And what are the wishes of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, I'd like to put forward a conceptual amendment to page 2, line 21, and after the word sent, insert both electronically and by postal service. And Madam Chair, that is conceptual, so if legal can put the right spin on things.
Hearing no objection, so passed. All right. Representative Fairclough.
Do you want me to move? All right, Representative Roses. I'm just going to steal all your thunder today.
What, you
I'll defer, sir.
Makes no difference. As long as it gets done.
They're going to train me, for those of you sitting in the audience. I'd like to move House Joint Resolution Number 10-25-LS0582/A from committee.
As amended.
As amended. And I don't believe there's a fiscal note with this one to confirm with the chair.
Okay. Which with individual recommendation?
Yeah, individual recommendation?
Yes. Okay. As amended is what you said. So.
Yeah. All right, hearing no objection, so moved. So we will proceed on to our presentation for today. And Carol Prentice, are you going to be the one that starts out?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Carol, I'll let you come forward and explain to us what the SEED program really is.
Excuse me just a minute while I get this back up.
Yep.
There we go.
Yeah, and if any of the rest of you want to come up here and be ready, that's fine too.
Madam Chair, if I could catch Rob before he leaves, may I have the floor while they're setting up? I just wanted to take this opportunity to congratulate Rob on a job well done as an intern. I thought you did an excellent job, and you did your research well.
Thank you very much.
I
agree.
It's not as easy as it looks, is it?
No, it isn't.
And Carol, I'll let you, as you go along, introduce whoever you want to so that you can just proceed with your presentation. Okay. And we'll kind of stop you kind of wherever as questions arise.
Fine.
Or unless you would rather not.
No, I think feel free to ask questions.
Okay.
Yes,
all right.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you to Representative Wilson and to the committee for providing the opportunity for us to present here today some what we believe to be very important information. And my name is Carol Prentice. I'm the project manager for SEED, which stands for System for Early Education Development. SEED is based at the University of Alaska Southeast, And appropriately, our primary mission is the professional development of people who work in the early childhood workforce sector. But I'm also joined here today by several of my colleagues who works in statewide organizations having to do with various aspects of early care and education. So you'll be hearing from several of them a little later on. The presentation that we have for you today is divided into a couple of different parts, and we'd like to start with what you see on the screen, which is the economic impact report on early education and child care services in Alaska. Just briefly, by way of background information, the Seed Council, who I'm accountable to, is a group of about 20 stakeholders in the state. And we're in our final year of funding. It's federal funding. And we're in our fourth and final cycle of that funding. So we stopped and thought, what could we do beyond what we have been doing that would have a, could have, has the potential to have a really lasting impact on young children throughout the state of Alaska? And we determined that commissioning an economic impact report was a way that we could have a really long-lasting effect. Our thinking behind that is that good policy comes from good data. And in Alaska, we've had a serious shortage of good data on the early childhood, many aspects of early childhood, but one being the workforce and the economic impact of that. So we determined to do that, and we commissioned the McDowell Group to conduct that study. So at this point, I would like to introduce Jim Calvin, who's a partner with the McDowell Group and has been the primary individual responsible for this study that's been conducted, and he has a PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you, Carol. For the record, my name is Jim Calvin. I'm managing partner with the McDowell Group. McDowell Group is a research and consulting firm with offices in Juneau, Anchorage, and Kodiak. We've been in business for the better part of 35 years, and over that period have conducted several hundred economic impact studies on virtually every sector of the Alaska economy for every part of the state. This study is our first effort ever to look at the economic impacts of early learning and child care as a component of our economy, and so far as we're aware, it's the first effort ever of its kind in Alaska. Let me talk a minute about the scope of our study. First of all, this analysis focuses just on services provided to children under 6 years of age. And it focuses just on the traditional child care early learning setting. So it doesn't include after-school programs for older kids, obviously. It doesn't include summer camp kinds of programs that many of us have sent our children to. It's focused just purely on services offered and provided to children under 6 years of age. We have measured the economic impact of this part of our economy in some of the traditional ways, which is in terms of jobs and income and how much money people, households, parents spend on securing child care services, as well as how much government agencies are spending and providing and referring child care services to Alaskan families. And there's also some interesting information about economic information about the role that the child care sector plays in making it possible for Alaskans to join the labor force and enhance their standard of living and family income situation. Let's start with a little bit of demographics here, just to know how big a piece of our population is this group of children. Where there's as of 2005, there was about just under 63,000 children in Alaska under 6 years of age. About two-thirds of those children reside in households where all available parents are in the labor force. If it's a two-parent household, both parents are worked. If it's a single-parent household, that parent is in the labor force as well. Now, some households have more than one child under six, and our estimates suggest that these children, these 39,000 children, reside in a total of about 29,400 households all across Alaska. That's about one in eight Alaska households. So one in eight Alaska households is using needs child care services of one form or another. I should say that this particular demographic has been growing at a faster rate than the population overall, about 1.7% annual growth rate here over the last year or so, compared to about 1% of the population overall. So it's a growing piece of our population.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Yes.
A little clarification there. Was that the 62,000 children in Alaska that are getting out of home child care? Or is this the total number of children?
There's 63,000 children under six. Of that, 39,000 are receiving child care of some, paying for and receiving child care of some sort. It can be in the home. They may pay, they're paying for some service in the home, in someone else's home, in a Head Start setting, in a child care center.
And Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. We have 62,000 under six. Can we assume that it's approximately 10,100 per age group? I mean, 62,000 divided by six is approximately 10,000.
Roughly. Right, yeah, in there. There certainly are bubbles that work for the population, but I think that's a fair assessment.
And then we have 40,000 households.
39,000 children. Where all the parents are in the workforce.
And that's birth to six.
Correct.
And so could we use...
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. I'm trying to read my numbers and think of my question. So we can assume that if we took that 39,000, divided that again by six.
Again, roughly, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
My question's answered. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right, proceed, Jim.
So I want to talk now about what might not be recognized as an economic impact associated with the availability of child care services. But as I said, there's 29,400 households in Alaska with children that are in a child care setting. That means that there's 29,400 Alaskans who are able to join the labor force who would otherwise not be able to join the labor force if not for the availability of some form of child care. That's about slightly under 10%, 9.5% of our resident labor force. So it's a pretty good chunk of our labor force is needs this kind of service. Now we don't know the income characteristics of this particular segment of our population precisely, but if we use some general averages in terms of per capita income, household income levels, we can surmise that this segment of our workforce earns $850 million, average of about $28,000 per family. So clearly the availability of child care services makes it possible for Alaskan families to substantially increase household income, standard of living. The average Alaska family earns about $72,000 a year. So you can see this component, this $28,000, is a big piece of the family income picture. Talk a minute about the jobs in this sector. This is, again, a more traditional. When we measure the economic impact of the oil industry or commercial fishing or tourism, we typically talk about how many jobs are created and what's the payroll.
Representative Seaton has a question.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's just one of those days I'm not following numbers well. So the total annual wages, so are you taking and saying that since there's this 29,000 families where both parents work, or 29,000 households where both parents work, then one half of that family income is attributable to somebody that has to go outside, or are you, I mean, this said both parents, so I'm not sure, or it's all parents work.
It's all
so
available period, but there's roughly a third of family households are single parent households in the state. So we're counting that all person in the labor force and earning income as well as one of the wage earners in the two parent household. And we're not suggesting that it's half of family income. Total family income, the average family income is about $72,000. We're estimating that income that's possible as a result of childcare service availability is about 28,000 of that, so not half, roughly less, slightly less than a third. Typically, it's the second wage earner, maybe a part-time job in a two-parent family. There may be a lot of part-time work that's adding to family income. In a single-family income, it's the only source of income.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
In any case, back to the jobs and income, our modeling work suggests that there are a total of 7,400 jobs in the Alaska economy that are directly or indirectly related to providing child care services to children under 6 years of age. And those 7,400 jobs generate about $124 million in annual payroll. That's the direct, indirect, induced, all of the multiplier effects associated with this sector of our economy. The direct jobs, that is the number of people that are actually out there providing services to children under six, is about 6,500 jobs, and they earn about $95 million in annual payroll.
Excuse me.
Representative Harden.
Thank you. With an eye to figuring out the average pay, could you give those figures again of the annual payroll and the number of child care workers?
We'll get to that one in a minute if you want to hang out for a couple of slides. We can talk about some of the wages. That's a very, very important point that we'll get to. The child care sector is not certainly one of our key basic industries in terms of its job creation or income creation potential. It's not an oil industry or a tourism or military or something. It's about 1.5% of our total employment base. There's roughly 400,000 jobs in the Alaska economy. So this is a fairly small slice if you look at it in that regard. However, if you look at it in comparison to some of the other aspects, other components of our, the infrastructure components of our economy, for example, number of people employed in air transportation is about 6,400. The number of people employed in residential and non-residential construction is 6,000. So if you look at it in comparison to other important industries that are more recognizable, it's a significant piece of our economic pie.
Representative Faircloth.
I just briefly glanced to the end to see if you've got any criteria that you're basing your statistics on. So what drives me is you're giving me a lot of numbers, and right now I don't know how to believe them or what credit to give them. How did you go about establishing under six, and what criteria base did you use? And then what factor did you use to multiply to get an average? Are you using just average wages, or how are you putting your how did you put your economic study together, and what did you base it on to come up with some of these numbers?
Not a simple question to answer in the time available, but pulling together all the data that we can find from various secondary sources, that is, any information from Department of Labor, any information from Bureau of Economic Analysis, there's census data, there's American Community Survey data, there's a fair amount of published government data that you can mine that helps piece this puzzle together. There is no, because so many people in this labor force are not recorded in Department of Labor data, it's not a simple analysis at all. So
that's where I'm wondering how you came up with your numbers and how soft they are or how hard they are. Where's the, what's the range that we're looking at here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm feeling pretty confident with the number of people that are earning income providing child care services. There's obviously many more folks out there that are providing grandmothers, aunts, others that are providing child care that aren't part of this economic equation that we're talking about.
Follow-up, Representative Care.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just give me one baseline statistic that you used in the calculation factor? Did you go to the federal an IRS form to look at what people reported as income? Give me one piece of evidence that you used to support your
The state's licensing database has, I can't tell you the number that it has, it's a complicated model with lots of numbers that are pulled together. The state's licensing database is a key source of background information.
And then the licensees would have a range again in there of what they could have houses. We would assume that they would maximize their licensing fee. Did you make that assumption?
I'm not sure I understand that.
They can only license for a specific amount of children.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So did you use the high number or the low number? Because there could, if you have a license, you could have one person or you could have five people, I believe, on site, five kids, depending on the age group that you were looking at.
So we also did a survey of child care providers to find out exactly what they're reporting. We have Department of Labor data, anyone that has an employee is required to report that employment to the Department of Labor. So we have, for each employer in the childcare sector in Alaska, we know exactly how many people they employed, their monthly employment, peak employment, and so forth. So we have pretty good data there as well.
I'll yield, Madam Chair. Representative Seaton.
Thanks. I was just trying to get a handle on this. On the direct jobs, about 6,500 direct jobs, how many of those are also in the previous category of those that are either single or families that are then up here in the slide above the annual wages of approximately $850 million? In other words, how many of the child care provider jobs are also someone that is working outside the house? So you have a you have a dual parent family, so we're taking, and one of those is one of these 6,500 jobs that's providing child care, or the single parent that is also taking those jobs. I mean, do we have any handle on the mesh? Are all almost all of those people represented in the upper figure as well?
I would say that relatively few of them. Certainly there's some overlap. Some of the 29,000 folks that are in the labor force because of the availability of child care services may also be employed in providing child care services, but that's a pretty small fraction of this piece. This is households all across Alaska that are able to join the labor force, go to work for local government, in the store, in the doctor's office, any place in the economy. There's really no correlation or connection between you and I having the opportunity to go out and get a job because we have someone to watch our kids and the people that are out there available and watching our kids for us. That's sort of two different things. Are there some people who are, some of the 29,000, taking jobs, providing child care services? Sure, I'm sure there is, but it's kind of an apples and oranges comparison.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Well, it wasn't the 29 into the 6,500. It was the question of the 6,500 that are providing the child care, how many of those are in the previous statistic as far as having a kid under six, and that are also, I mean, all those people under six that are employed, I'm just trying to figure out if those statistics mesh or not, but that's okay.
Short answer is no, they don't mesh. They're two different measures of two different things.
Okay. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at those numbers, I'm curious about what size community at which those jobs start falling off. In other words, I would assume that the major urban centers in Alaska have the largest number of child care workers, but and that in smaller communities it's more informal and there may not be, and maybe economic, but it's not going to be, it's going to be trading and it's going to be other things that are probably harder to measure. Mm-hmm. Did you figure out a kind of distribution across from smaller to larger communities on that?
Yeah. In fact, we conducted a statewide household survey and mm-hmm. asked those kinds of questions. Perhaps if I just proceed with the presentation, we'll get to that one and then we can answer some
Sorry.
Of the other
I didn't
questions.
See that.
We surveyed 700 households all across the state in an effort to find out just what sorts of child care services people are using, how much they're paying for it. And there's the point you make very well is there's very big differences between urban Alaska and rural Alaska in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while Representative Gardner was asking her question, the same question popped into my mind. And that was with the, I'm just trying to put the numbers into my mind on what we're talking about here when we're looking at these charts. When you had a direct and indirect employment impact of 7,400 people in the workforce with a combined total wages of $124 million. And when I was just kind of doing my division here, going back to sixth grade, that's about $168,172 per person, which figuring an income of $30,000 average across the state, you used an economic multiplier of almost six.
I think it's, you might have missed a decimal place in there. It's about 16 to 20,000 is what the typical household, what the typical worker in the industry will earn. There's, again, I've got some data coming up here if you want to proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's possible.
Representative Faircloth.
I appreciate the survey. Can you tell me what kind of, did you use a random digit dial or what, how'd you base your survey together? It's on there? Okay, yeah. Awful.
Well, we'll let you go right ahead.
This gets to the issue of wages. And as I indicated, there's a substantial number of jobs in this sector of our economy, but they're generally low wages, a lot of part-time employment. The typical child care worker, depending on which data set you use, whether it's DEA or Department of Labor, some numbers place it as low as $16,000 per annual average job, up to as much as $21,000, which is what we're showing here. I'll put this into perspective. The average wage in the Alaska economy is $38,000. So the average wage that is paid to the people that we entrust care of our youngest children to is just slightly more than half of the industry, of the economy-wide average. In other words, they're among our poorest paid workers in the economy. Part of our research included looking at some national data on some of the longer-term socioeconomic benefits associated with quality early learning opportunities. Again, none of this is Alaska-specific data, but I think there's still some relevance here. It kind of points us in the direction of what some of the social benefits or socioeconomic benefits might be. Here's a few bullet points. For children that have been, were in quality early learning situations, they experienced 29% higher high school graduation rates. They experienced 20% higher college attendance rates, and over their lives typically earned more money than those that weren't in quality early learning settings. Now again, these are some very specific small-scale long-term research projects that focus to a large degree on disadvantaged children, but it just sort of illustrates what some of the benefits can be from access to these kind of programs. Some other statistics, again, children that were in quality early learning programs had 70% lower crime incident rates later in life, 20% lower welfare dependence, again, later in life. So interesting and important messages here about what this could mean for Alaska, but again, none of this is Alaska data.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one of the things that concerns me when we look at numbers like this, and in particular, I guess it's two slides back, the one that has the red slide with long-term economic impact. Yeah, that one, and I suppose the other ones too, is if we see the correlation between quality child care and higher high school graduation rates, that does not, it's not the same thing as cause and effect. If you have, say, a family with two working parents who are higher income and therefore have higher quality child care because they're willing to pay more, maybe they have a nanny in their own home instead of their child in a large institution or something, that would correlate with the high school graduation rate, and it isn't necessarily the child care itself that promotes that, but simply the things that allow good child care.
Good point. And again, there's a fairly deep reservoir of research that's looked into what the benefits and costs are of early learning programs, early child care, quality child care programs, including some that are fairly intensive in-home mm-hmm. visit kinds of things. And all I can do at this point is refer you to some national research that suggests this issue. Our effort here was not to do this for Alaska, simply go out and see what some of the conclusions were of research on this topic that were done in Chicago and some rural areas down south. Your points are totally valid, though.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a good chart to talk about this, maybe, is when we look at these numbers, how would we associate these numbers? Because your numbers look at birth to six, And I think that there's probably a question, at least in my mind, of if the state was to try and fund, you know, six-month-old or one-year-old's childcare in a relationship to our return, economically speaking, back to society, you know, with our educational costs on that. If we were to look at this number or these numbers and say, okay, we want to, this is birth to six. If we had 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, would these numbers change significantly if we only looked at 4, 5, and 6-year-olds?
A question I can't answer. Again, there may be answers to those kinds of questions in some of the national research. Our focus really was in two areas. One is, what are the measurable economic impacts in Alaska from this part of our economy? And secondarily, what do households think about, or how do households in Alaska prioritize the importance of state government financial support for the provision of early learning child care services, which is the survey I'm about to talk about. You've got very valid questions, and if I were in your shoes, I would want answers to those questions as well. We far, far beyond the scope of our research, however, in this case.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm scribbling on here trying to make this less confusing. I think the confusion comes from it appears like this is Alaska seed and this will produce this. And what you're really meaning is that a smaller study looking at quality health care or quality early child development produced these results out someplace else. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that clears it up for me. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
As I indicated, part of our research effort included a telephone survey of 725 randomly selected households scattered throughout Alaska. The primary purpose of this survey was to help us understand just what sort of child care services Alaskan households are using and how much they're paying for them. We also, however, collected some very interesting information about general public attitudes towards the importance of some level of state government support for child care services. As we described earlier, there's some pretty important differences in this regard in urban Alaska versus rural Alaska. So our analysis essentially divided up our data into three subgroups. One is urban Alaska, which we defined as any community over 8,000 people. We had a rural one designation that we separately analyzed the survey results, and that's for communities of 2,000 to 8,000, and a rural two designation, which is any place under 2,000 people. Total population. So the smallest of our rural Alaska. 58% of the children in surveyed households that had children under six were in child care service, were receiving child care services of some kind, which matches with the census data. So we feel good about the quality of our sample in terms of its statistical reliability. Here's some of the, again, in the time we have available to us, we can't really wade into too much detail here, but some of the most interesting findings include this, which is that among households with children under six, 36% said that either the quality, the cost, or the availability of child care services in their area had prevented someone in the household from seeking employment or in some way restricted their ability to work as many hours as they would like. So for a third of all the households with children under six, cost, quality, or availability of child care services is constraining their ability to work as much as they would like. We asked folks what the most important factors were, and cost was the primary constraint that most folks were feeling. With about half all saying that, yeah, the primary constraint I feel is the cost of the child care services available to me locally. About a quarter of these households said that it was an issue of quality, and about a quarter said it was an issue of availability. In rural Alaska, the pie is a little bit different, with about 50% of households saying that its availability is the issue, not so much cost. 50% said availability was the primary issue, 25% said cost, and 25% said quality. Cost data here, this again from our survey research and some other data suggests that the cost of a month of childcare services ranges from $400 to $900, depending on the age of the child and the location of the household and the service. Gives you a sense of the cost that families feel that have two children under six. So big family expenditures involved, yet one in seven Alaska households with children under six in child care services receive some sort of financial assistance to secure those services. Another interesting finding from our survey research, we asked households, not just those with children, but all households, whether they think it's important or very important, or not at all important for state government to provide financial support for early education and child care services. And almost 9 out of 10 said it's either important or very important. 56% said it's very important. Another 31% thought it was important. So clearly this issue is, like other aspects of education, is important in terms of people's perception for the importance of government support.
Representative Newman has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I find this slide somewhat intriguing. And I wonder, have you broke it down? You say 87% of Alaskans think it is important or very important for state government to provide financial support for early education and child care. Did you take the time to break it out and see how many people thought maybe we should provide funding for early education? I would think it would be substantially less people would think the state government should provide financial services for child care. Did you look at both of those?
A good question that we talked a great length about internally and with our client. And basically, quality child care is early education. So we considered the two together. We didn't. You're right. We might have got a different response if we'd asked, do you think state governments should support quality child care? Might be different than supporting early education. But then they're one and the same, really. If someone is willing to provide financial support for early education, that's what quality child care is early education. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question well, but
follow up, Representative.
Thank you. No, you really didn't kind of answer it because you stated that it probably would be substantially less for if you asked people if they wanted to provide for child care. But then you said you felt child care is good early education. So. I mean, as an expert, as somebody who did do the surveying here, can you give us your expert estimate on what those divisions might be?
Well, no. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that they are the same thing. No one would like to provide financial support for low quality child care services or just babysitting services. But that's a foregone conclusion. I think everyone would say, well, no, of course not. What Carol and others involved in this are suggesting is that. Should government provide, should there be some form of support for quality child care, which essentially is an educational experience, is not just a babysitting experience. I can't answer your question any better than that. No, we didn't ask if people would support babysitting responsibilities. We did ask if they would support just quality early education.
All but Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but we're talking birth to six, and I think when we talk about the learning abilities, I think that it's somewhat questionable when we talk about a six-month-old child or a one-year-old child receiving quality educational experiences in that. So that's, I would just be interesting to see what that number is, to see how many people thought state funding should provide for child care from birth to six.
Yeah. Excellent point. I guess I would just encourage everyone to focus on sort of the broader messages that we're trying to produce with this research. And you know, one is that the availability of child care services is sort of an essential part of standard of living for Alaska families. If we didn't have it, their family incomes would be much, much less than they are now. Another sort of broad point is that based on this first ever effort to gauge in some way public attitudes around whether there should be some form of government support for early education, quality child care, and the answer is there appears to be pretty strong support for this. Do we know all the answers? course not. Another key point, I think, is that the availability, the cost, the quality of available childcare is still a major issue for Alaska households. Those are the three points that we really want to convey with this study. Your question is a good one. I think follow-on research would be an excellent idea to find out more about how, what kinds of programs people think state government ought to fund, if any, where money ought to come from, for example, to fund those kind of programs.
Thank you. Okay.
And I think, and I've got two more people that want to ask questions yet, but I think what the committee is trying to get at here a little bit is the people in this state don't know what it's like that they have to take things out of their pocketbook, because there's no state, you know, there's no statewide tax, so that people don't have to do it. So if you say, is the state going to do it? Yeah, let the state do it. You know, I mean, that's kind of a little bit of the state of Alaska doesn't realize lots of times that because they don't have to take it out of their pocket and give it to the state so the state can do it. And every other state in the union, that's not quite the same. And so I think that's where they're coming from a little bit, so that when you ask somebody in Alaska, if you ask somebody in the lower 48 that same question, they're going to say, they're going to be thinking, oh, will that mean my taxes are going to go up? What does that mean? Well, in Alaska, nobody has a concept, because they don't have to pay anything to the state, you know, individually. And so it's a different concept, and I think you'll get more of an answer like that in Alaska than you would somewhere else just because of that. And, you know, and I could be wrong, but I think that we have to realize that Alaska is totally different up here, and that is one aspect that people don't think about sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's easy to say, yeah, let the state do it, you know. They want the state to do everything, but we can't do everything, you know. But anyway, I think that's where we're coming from. But Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very good point. If we could, instead of saying the state, substitute the other guy. And that's really a prevalent attitude. But thank you, Madam Chair. In follow-up to Representative Newman's questions, I've been kind of thinking along the same lines that early education and child care are not the same thing. And here's kind of an example of the way I see it. I got an email this summer from somebody who said, my children's school is looking for teachers. If you know anybody, have them contact such and such. The children in question were 2 months and 13 months old, and I would posit they were not at school. They were at childcare. They were at daycare, and they don't have teachers. They have daycare providers or something along those lines. And the implication of that question, you know, my two-month-old needs a new teacher, is silly. I mean, given that children are always learning, not everybody they are in, I mean, everybody, every contact they have in a sense is with the teacher, but what those children were in is daycare, not school. And we as a society are kind of lulling ourselves by saying that we're sending our infants to school, because we're not. So what I'm interested in, this leads to actually my question for you, is when we see surveys, phone surveys, and I know some of your data came from direct surveys and some from other forms, I'd be very interested in seeing the actual question, because I think it has an impact on the answer that we get.
Certainly, yeah.
Representative Roses.
Well, it's pretty much along the same lines that they had, but the concern I have, because I understand you're trying to give a general overview to substantiate some of the findings that you have to talk about why an early ready-to-read program is going to be beneficial to the state and why we should fund it. I understand the dynamic of where we're going here, but when you use that kind of a question, the reason it gives some of us some pause is the next slide, where it says Alaskans place a priority on it. And if we're going to say that Alaskans place priority on it, then we need to separate it out. So I would just say that in the future, if you try to use this kind of results, it would be very helpful if you split it out, because if this question had been asked of me, I would have said, is there a way to split that out? Because I am a strong advocate for early education. I am not a strong advocate necessarily for state-funded childcare. And so they're not the same question. And so that's why I think you know, some of us are taking a little bit of pause here, and I realize you're catching a lot of flack necessarily here for trying to make an overview, and so I don't want to overstate it, but I think that's why you're getting some concern from us, because we are going to be faced with looking at potentially $38 million worth of cuts in health and social services areas. Some of the child care stuff falls underneath those parameters, and then to have this kind of thing that comes up that says Alaskans strongly support it, it gives some of us some great pause. So that's why I think you're seeing the resistance. And so I could go on, but I'll stop.
Well, and I think, too, it really makes a difference. There's a big difference between quality daycare and a babysitter. There is a huge difference. You can, as long as you feed the baby and change the baby and the baby's happy, but you could have him laying in that bed all day, you know. And or you could be cooing to it and talking to it and visiting with it and have enough people there that you're stimulating that child, you know. And so, but I still would have a hard time saying that was school, you know. But there is a difference in the quality of daycare. There's no doubt about that. And the research does show that the more you stimulate and the more you talk and do all that type of thing, that it really makes a huge difference for these kids. So, that there is a huge difference when they have quality care versus just a babysitter. So, but anyway, continue, and we'll try not to ask any more questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your interest in the topic. This is a project that we ate, slept, and breathed for better part of a year, and it's very interesting. I think there's some points here that are it's big picture research trying to get their first glimpse of what Alaskans think about these issues. This slide, we asked folks whether they would give funding for early education and child care a high priority, a medium priority, or low priority. And we also asked that of households in terms of K-12 education, university education, and some other normal government functions like new roads and highways and support for local governments. And again, this is just trying to give you a sense of where this falls on people's radar screens. It doesn't rate as highly as K-12 education in terms of its priority. It rates a little bit higher than university education. None of this is very surprising to us. We've done hundreds of surveys in Alaska over the last 20 years, and invariably when you ask questions about prioritizing government expenditures on government services, K-12 education comes out on top every time. University education often comes out as in second place, typically comes out in second place. This is the first time we've broached the issue of, well, what about early learning? What about quality child care where you're doing more than babysitting, where there's reading and there's interaction and there's projects for not for the infants. This is more of a, you know, the 3, 4, 5-year-old. This gives you a sense that people give this some priority relative to where government is spending some of its other resources. That's the only message. There's a lot of details about what kinds of programs people might support and where money come from. Carol and her folks can talk a lot more about that. But again, the survey research says this people do have some concerns about this and might be willing to support some measure of formal support so that Alaska isn't only one of ten states in the nation that doesn't have some form of government, state government supported program. This is, again, more economics. Our survey research indicated that Alaskan households spend about $150 million on child care, securing child care services in 2005. The federal government spends $74 million in Alaska on providing these kinds of services and supporting these services. State government pitches in about $13 million. All told, that's $238 million, I think, spent securing or providing services. About $225 million of that is actually in providing services rather than in the balance is administrative overhead. So it's not an administrative overhead industry as we would typically define one. And I'm going to ask Carol to talk about this one, which discusses where Alaska stands nationally in state-funded child care programs.
Thank you. Well, I'll do that, and then I have a couple of other comments. But this is just to point out that in the United States, that Alaska is only one of 10 states without a state-funded statewide early childhood education system.
That means a lot of different things in different states. It doesn't mean every state has a fully funded early care and education system. Some states have an early learning council based in state government that oversees public-private partnerships in different aspects. Some do have some pilot programs or are developing private pilot programs, or even more than pilot programs in pre-K. So it doesn't mean the same thing for every state, but Alaska is one of the 10 that doesn't have any aspect of that. I also just wanted to point out that we do have the full report, and Becky, I don't know if I leave this with you or can get more copies to you, that does give a lot of the methodology. It does give the specific questions, how the questions were asked, and some of the questions that you were, good questions that you were asking are addressed in here.
Representative Roses?
Just a quick question in terms of some other, not this particular survey, but if in your studies, if you had a correlation between how many states now currently fund full-day kindergarten as opposed to those that still have half-day, because it's, I recall we had this debate before the state for many, many years trying to, you know, advocate for funding for full-day kindergarten as opposed to half-day. So, you know, when you say we're one of 10 states, it would be interesting to see how many of the 50 states actually their state funds full-day kindergarten as opposed to still having half-day.
Right, that is, and I don't know the answer to that question.
I think it would be an interesting correlation.
It's a good,
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Could you just tell me the name of the title of that report?
This report?
Yeah.
It's the same title as the summary, but this full, okay. They do look quite different. The one you have is much more attractive, the summary that looks...
based on...
Yeah, the 10 or 12 page booklet, and this is the full report.
And it's entirely
economic impact of early education and child care services in Alaska.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm happy to provide that.
Thank you.
Maybe we should have at the beginning, but would it be all right to go ahead and call up a couple of other speakers?
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Good.
Madam Chair, I was holding.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Fairclough.
Just wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to talk about that survey. Becky, if I could get a copy.
Yeah, I'll get one.
And more what I wanted to know is I'm looking for your data point selection, and I hope that will tell me whether you used a phone or mailing or multiple.
Telephone survey.
And then you incorporated that in with other types of information?
For the economic analysis, yes. The telephone survey did two things. It helped us understand the kinds of child care services people were using today,
mm-hmm.
Whether it was 5 hours a week, 10 hours a week, full-time, and how much they were spending for those services, whether they had some sort of employer or other financial support to help them with their child care services. And then sort of secondary to that was a series of questions that attempted to get at this issue of where people viewed potential funding for child care services on their radar relative to K-12 education and university education and others. So two basic purposes for the survey. So.
If I might, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Kerr.
The 750, those were answered surveys? There were completed, 725
yes.
Completed surveys.
Yes.
And so did you use a random digit dial, or did you use, this is my concern, and so to help you try to answer the question, if we only survey people who have phones, then we're not really getting at the impoverished people who may not participate like that. And so we have to know the group that we're looking at when we look at the data, which is going to possibly exclude many rural communities that might not have phone service. So that's, I'm trying to see how we...
The vast majority of Alaska households have phones. You're right, there's a few percentage points that don't.
Well, more and more people are switching to cell phones as their primary, and that's why I was, how did you do random digit dial, or did you use the phone system, or?
You can't do random digit dial in rural Alaska. Few numbers. So we use random digit dial in Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks. Otherwise, you have to rely on a phone book and do a random selection out of the phone book.
Interesting trying to get to a conclusion. I totally understand the challenge. No sales tax in the state means that data sometimes is hard to collect from different pictures in the state. Not to do with this issue, but economics.
Representative Gardner and then Representative Newman.
Thank you. I just wanted to say before Mr. Calvin left that I appreciate your testimony, and I can tell that you have a passion for this work and this issue, and that's the kind of thing that for me personally, makes this job, my job, so much fun is working with people who really, really care about what they're doing. And while our questions might be pointed, and I hope that you don't think they're hostile or unappreciative of your work.
Not at all,
thank you.
Thank you. I try to be the objective researcher as much as I can. This has been a fascinating and a very important study.
Good.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Mr. Kelvin, I echo the same sentiment as just spoken, but that's just our job. Anyhow, my question is, how much did it cost to do this study? Because there's been a lot of studies on early education and the importance of early education. I don't think there's a person on this committee who doesn't feel that that's important. But how much did this study cost, including, I mean, it's a beautiful brochure, but these cost a lot of money. What did this total study cost, and who paid for it?
SEED, the System for Early Education Development, that's funded by the Department of Education, Federal Department of Education, funded the project. I'd have to look at the numbers, but I believe that it was about $60,000 for the that included the telephone research and the other all the aspects of the research that are included in this document. We took this document and we had the Nerland Agency in Anchorage convert that to a more accessible format, which you have in your hands. I'd have to look it up, and we had multiple copies, but it seems like the actual cost per copy is about $1.60 per summary.
Follow up quickly.
Follow up, Representative Newman. And then,
Madam Chair, just real
quick. Yeah, because we're not going to be able to get everybody to testify if we're running out of time here. Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify, and this is just yesterday, that was about $460,000, and it was all federal funds?
$60,000
total cost.
$60,000 that was our contract to the McDowell Group. These the documents you have are approximately, and again I'd have to look this up, $1.60 per document, and we've had a couple of different reprints of them now. So I'd have to.
And it was all federal.
And it was all funded through the Department of Federal Department of Education.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the SEED grant.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much, and I think it'd be good to get into the meat of it now that we've
Great.
Gotten some of the the data, because I don't want to short the rest of the presentation. So.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'd like to go ahead then and introduce the two next people to speak, who are Abby Hensley, who's the Executive Director of the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Initiative, and Joy Lyon, who's the Executive Director of the Association for the Education of Young Children in Southeast Alaska.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, I know time is running out here. Could you just help me by, what time do we have until?
We probably have about 20 minutes yet.
Okay, thank you very much. I am Abby Hensley, the Director of the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Initiative, and thank you very much for allowing us to come and share information with you. And I am going to share information with you. I have no data to provide. The Ready to Read, Ready to Learn can best be described as a public-private collaborative effort providing leadership for Alaska's investment in its youngest citizens, ensuring a best beginning for children and a vital future for Alaska. And we've provided you with a copy of our report and a fact sheet about the initiative. Ready to Read, Ready to Learn is co-managed by the Alaska Humanities Forum and United Way of Anchorage. And staff for the initiative is really a tangible demonstration of that collaborative arrangement. I work for the Alaska Humanities Forum, and my colleague, Melinda Myers, who's in the back, is on loan from United Way. And I'd also like to introduce to you David White, who is the retired CEO of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, who was a member of the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force, and is continuing on as a member of our new board, the Early Learning Council. So Ready to Read, Ready to Learn, which began with an interest in early literacy and low reading levels as children move through school, has come through that recommendation process, and we've been working on the issues. As the task force was formed, and you'll see a list of those people in the report, and began to study the issues, one thing was particularly compelling, and that was the advances in early brain development research, which shed even more light on the capacity of the young brain and underscored the importance of the early years. And for those of you who were at the presentation that the task force made last spring, you might have heard Bridget Chandler, who talked about the fact that during these early years, particularly during the time between 0 and 2, there's all this time of synaptic exuberance, as she calls it. And she talked about the fact that during that time, it can be described as a time when all the lights are on and everybody's home. So those years really are important for us to focus on. As we came up with the recommendations with the task force, and I was a member of the task force as well, we really kept in mind the fact that families are at the heart of all this, and it's families that we need to focus on. So you'll see a brief overview of the recommendations on pages 2 and 3 of the report, and because we have little time, I'm going to be very brief about that, but I know that you have the report and you can look at it later. The in-the-home section of the report, and there are 3 recommendations there, I think, as I said, really are at the foundation of what we're talking about. And the recommendation about increasing the engagement of parents, grandparents, and other extended family in early learning with their young children, I think, is really the foundation of it. And one of the things that we're doing to help further that recommendation, funded by private donations, is a public engagement campaign to help parents and others and community members understand the importance of the early years and the simple, easy things that people can do that can really make a difference with their children. The support for what you hear today from my colleagues, too, can be found in one or more of these recommendations. And support can be found for the strengthening families model that you'll hear more about later this week. I wanted also to call your attention to the document that you have called Investing in Alaska's Young Children that looks like this. And on the second page at the top, there's a list which includes some of the recommendations from our report, but also a couple of other statements about the importance of supporting families, supporting young families in Alaska so that children can grow up and be productive citizens in our state. Last year, you and your colleagues appropriated $250,000 to further the work of Ready to Read, Ready to Learn. And the fact sheet that we have provided along with the report lists out some of the things that we have accomplished and some of the work that we've undertaken with $167,000 of that $250,000, along with support from the private sector. Well, I wanted to share with you, too, that currently the governor's budget includes $1.5 million to further Ready to Read, Ready to Learn recommendations, and it's in the Department of Education and Early Development. Now, that those recommendations that might fund would not necessarily be carried out by Melinda and me. There is just the two of us, but certainly to further the recommendations in general. We're supporting this funding request, and I think, again, it's important to note that this is a collaborative effort that we're working with the department to figure out how to further the goals. A couple of other things are also intended to be funded with that money. One is to further the development of the early learning guidelines, which were put together by the Department of Health and Social Services and Education Early Development and then endorsed by the State Board of Education. Health and Social Services is about to print that document, but it's quite large. As you can imagine, it really lays out what we as Alaskans think children between 0 and 5 ought to know, understand, and do, and be able to do. And so what we want to also be sure is that parents can get that information in ways that are easy for them to use and also to be translated into other languages. There are a couple of other things. One, that we want to have more community conversations to help understand what people in our state really do think about early learning, and to build on the work that we're doing now with private funds that will help us think about what a system of early education might look like in our state. One of the major pieces, too, that we are looking to continue work on during this next year in collaboration with the state is a quality rating system for childcare and early learning programs. There were two, this is not new stuff, two pilot projects have been, have taken place in our state, which have shown very positive results. And as a part of last year's fund, well, this year, 07 money, we have contracted with an amazing team of national experts to help design a quality rating system that will work in Alaska. And there's a handout in your packet, too, on quality rating system. And I want to let my colleague, Joy Lyon, talk more about what quality rating system, and system is really an operating word there. It's not just a checkoff list, but something that is designed to improve the quality of child care in our state so that children who participate in those kinds of programs really can come to school ready to read, ready to learn. So thank you very much for my sort of zipping through that. And I'd love to have the opportunity, as we have with some of you, to have more conversation about these issues.
And Joy, before you, when you give your presentation, would you tell us where the pilot programs were conducted?
Thank you and good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Joy Lyon, the director of the Association for the Education of Young Children in Southeast Alaska, and I'm here representing the Alaska Resource and Referral Network today. We have three partner agencies that are all grantees of the Department of Health and Social Services to promote quality child care through supportive services to families, to programs, and to communities. My partners in Anchorage are Child Care Connection and then CARES in Fairbanks. So I'd just like to start by saying I'm very excited to be here today because I feel after 10 years in the field that this is the closest we've really ever been to having a real comprehensive system in our state. You know, sitting next to, you know, someone representing United Way and the Alaska Humanities Forum and all of the business and colleagues that Abby represents, and also the Alaska Seed, having the University of Alaska sponsorship and, you know, through funding support from Senator Stevens, and then having this data, having the McDowell Group, the credible study that gives us some a beginning onto understanding some of the issues out there for families and where children are. So that is our goal, is to have a system in place in Alaska that coordinates our efforts so that no matter where children are, if they're at home with their parents or with a relative, or if they're in Head Start or in a child care program or preschool, the outcome is the same of having a unified, consistent, supportive environment, a learning environment that prepares them for school and also for school success, for success as citizens. As we heard earlier, the violence increase in our state, that this is one place, this is where the social-emotional development happens, and the first 3 years of life is the window of opportunity that really impacts where children are socially and emotionally and their relationships.